Hello, everybody. Paul Boyer here for the Mad Money Machine Show 162, middle of July 2009. Mad Money Machine is one of the longest running investment podcasts available in iTunes. If you don't believe me, check it out for yourself. And it's also back in the featured listings of iTunes. Remember how last show I asked the question, since I missed the month of June, they took me out of the featured section, and I was hoping that if I did another show, they'd put me back in, and there I am again. So welcome, new listeners, if you found out about the Mad Money Machine, which was rated by U.S. News & World Report as one of the top 10 investing podcasts, and Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine says Mad Money Machine is a must-read blog. We've got a potpourri of topics to discuss for you today on the Mad Money Machine. I want to thank you for joining me. I really enjoy talking to you and sharing with you some things that are going on in Planet Boyer. One of the interesting things that I came across in the past few weeks is the Econ Talk podcast with Russ Roberts. He interviewed a guy, a journalist, who took a job at Walmart just to see just how bad it was, right? I mean, he had read that book about the lady who couldn't make it on a minimum wage job, and so he said, well, I'm going to try it myself and go to work for Walmart. He described the hiring process and described working there. I think he worked there for less than 1 week, as it turns out. But one of the things he was really impressed with, and I think Russ Roberts was impressed with, was the fact that every Walmart associate who works out on the floor, who works a particular department in Walmart, has a great deal of responsibility, actually, for choosing what items to sell and what price to sell those items for. And I know from, I read Sam Walton's book that came out 15 or so years ago, and he talked about how it was always fun for him to design the end caps and try to put together little fun promotions about the products that he would sell in his stores in Arkansas. And I guess the Walmart corporate philosophy is to try to continue that through on down to each and every sales associate on the floor and let them be responsible for their section in a significant way. And then they have weekly meetings to talk about who had a successful department that week. Russ Roberts commented that's a very Hayekian approach. Hayekian meaning distribution of control around the store instead of a centralized control, instead of some manager in Arkansas saying, okay, the store in Wisconsin, we want to sell more shovels there. The store in Nebraska, we want to sell additional rifles or whatever. You know, no, each individual store is in control of their own destiny. And that's the way I think it works best, don't you? Well, I'm reading lots and lots of books. Let me get my list. This is not an all-inclusive list. I had told you that I was reading Atlas Shrugged. Now, well, I took it to Myrtle Beach. This was the one book I took to Myrtle Beach, and I was going to sit out on the beach and try to work my way through it. Very heavy book, what, 1,100, 1,300 pages or something in hardback. How many pages do you think I got through Atlas Shrugged while I was sitting on the beach those 10 days we were in Myrtle Beach last month? One page. So I've got a lot more reading there to go. It's not that I don't enjoy the book. I guess I do enjoy it, but it's just getting a little bit plodding along at the moment. I'm anxious to see how it turns out. Also reading Primal Body, Primal Mind, which I was turned on to by Fathead, the movie. Fatheadthemovie.com. And he interviewed her. I can't pronounce her last name. Gedgaudas, something like that. Nora Gedgaudas. And it's about diet and trying to get back to what humans really should eat. Pretty interesting book. I read Stumbling on Happiness, which is a book. It's not a how-to guide to be happy. It's a book about psychological testing and how people think more so than how people are happy, I'd have to say. And I'm also picked up a book from our newly renovated library called Good Calories, Bad Calories. Also turned on to this one by Fathead, the movie. By Gary Taubes. This one I don't recommend that you actually read it. It's 600 pages long, including the index. It's not a diet book. It's not an Atkins diet or a protein power. It's not a book like that. This book, he has spent 7 years researching the scientific evidence and scientific literature on what makes a good diet. And his contention is that a lot of what we're being told about our diets are not scientifically sound. A lot of what we've been told about our diets, I guess, has been more politically motivated than it is scientifically sound motivated. I guess it's the global warming of diet. But if you want to get to his actual recommendations on diet, you have to turn all the way back to page 454 in the epilogue. He has 10 points. And he says this, as I emerge from this research, certain conclusions seem inescapable to me based upon the existing knowledge. And he has these 10 points. So I'll save you the trouble of going to the library to get the book by reading the 10 points for you. Number one, dietary fat, whether saturated or not, is not the cause of obesity or heart disease or any other chronic disease of civilization. Number two, the problem is the carbohydrates in the diet, their effect on insulin secretion, and thus the hormonal regulation of homeostasis, the entire harmonic ensemble of the human body. The more easily digestible and refined the carbohydrates, the greater the effect on our health, weight, and well-being. So, highly refined carbohydrates, bad, like white flour, white sugar, etc. Number three, sugars. Sucrose and high fructose corn syrup specifically are particularly harmful because the combination of fructose and glucose simultaneously elevates insulin levels while overloading the liver with carbohydrates. Number four, through their direct effect on insulin and blood sugar, refined carbohydrates, starches, and sugars are the dietary cause of coronary heart disease and diabetes. They are the most likely dietary causes of cancer, Alzheimer's disease, and the other chronic diseases of civilization. What are? I'm now extrapolating and saying, what is wrong? Well, it is refined carbohydrates are the bad thing in the diet. Number five, obesity is a disorder of excess fat accumulation, not overeating, and not sedentary behavior. I'll read it again. Obesity is a disorder of excess fat accumulation. And if you get into the details of the book, he talks about the hormones and particularly insulin. If you have insulin in your bloodstream, then your body can't release fat from the fat cells. Number six, consuming excess calories does not cause us to grow fatter any more than it causes a child to grow taller. Expending more energy than we consume does not lead to long-term weight loss. It leads to hunger. So he makes a case, and I've seen some newspaper articles that he's written that makes the case that you can't lose weight even exercising. Wow. 7. Fattening and obesity are caused by an imbalance, a disequilibrium, in the hormonal regulation of adipose tissue and fat metabolism. Fat synthesis and storage exceed the metabolism of fat from the adipose tissue and its subsequent oxidation. We become leaner when the hormonal regulation of the fat tissue reverses this balance. 8. Insulin is the primary regulator of fat storage. When insulin levels are elevated, either chronically or after a meal, we accumulate fat in our fat tissue. When insulin levels fall, we release fat from our fat tissue and use it for fuel. 9. By stimulating insulin secretion, carbohydrates make us fat and ultimately cause obesity. The fewer carbohydrates we consume, the leaner we will be. And 10, by driving fat accumulation, carbohydrates also increase hunger and decrease the amount of energy we expend in metabolism and physical activity. Well, so he gets into some of the issues in the epilogue here too of, is he recommend, you know, he doesn't recommend a no carbohydrate. Wait a minute, let me say this more correctly. He doesn't have a recommendation of what kind of diet to eat. He just knows that carbohydrate is the bad thing. He doesn't know whether a no carbohydrate diet is proper. He thinks there should be scientific studies about that. He doesn't know if maybe a low carbohydrate diet is appropriate. But he certainly does suggest that we get all we need from eating meat and fats. In fact, he talks about one population that all they ever ate was fish and coconuts, and they were quite healthy. So that was an interesting book. Good Calories, Bad Calories by Gary Taubes. And also on the web, I saw a one-hour lecture that he gave to other doctors talking about this concept. And I'm sure if you do a Google search for Gary Taubes, you'll come across that lecture that he gave. Taubes is his last name. Think there's too much government in your life? Well, if you're living in the Australian town of Bundanoon, you might just be right. The Australian town of Bundaloon has voted to ban bottled water just hours after the New South Wales government announced its own H2O boycott. So what is this all about? According to the Daily Telegraph, the sleepy Southern Highlands hamlet of Bundanoon has voted to ban bottled water just hours, blah, blah. Okay, at a community meeting last night, Bundanoon officials overwhelmingly supported the Australia first ban on commercially bottled water, already agreed to by businesses in the town. Local businessman and Bundy on Tap organizer Hugh Kingston said almost 400 people turned up in the Bundanoon Memorial Hall, with only 2 casting dissenting votes. The voluntary ban has been triggered by concerns about the carbon footprint associated with bottling and transporting the water. Free water fountains will be installed in the NSW village southwest of Sydney to replace the bottled H2O. Well. What do we think about this? Certainly, plastics are evil. Plastics are polluting the earth. And banning them is certainly the way to get around this, right? Or is it? So, first of all, who's to say that someone adds a drop of lemon flavoring into a bottle of water and calls it light lemonade? Is that now banned? Second of all, if there's only 2 people dissenting and not voting for the ban, then who were all the people buying the bottled water in the first place? And why didn't they show up for this meeting? Third thing is, Why do we have to lord over every one of our neighbors? Why do we have to be our neighbor's parent all the time? Is it really government's role to be everyone else's parent? Can't people decide for themselves what they want to do and not do? Do we have to regulate everything in everyone's lives? Do we have to outlaw bottled water? If people want bottled water, shouldn't they be allowed to buy it? If people think bottled water is not good, shouldn't they be allowed to not buy it? Why do you have to force someone else not to buy bottled water? What is the actual problem you're trying to get around? Is it the litter of the plastics? Isn't there some other solution besides just completely banning bottled water? Isn't there some other creative solution you can think of to eliminate the nuisance of the plastics? Surely there's something else you can think of besides banning bottled water. And the last thing I'll say is the quality of the tap water the same as the water that's found in the bottle? I mean, sure, there's people that are skeptical about bottled water, and they say that it's just tap water anyway. It's just a way to transport tap water. But if someone believes that their bottled water is of higher quality than the tap water, shouldn't they be allowed to drink water of the quality that they deem fit for their own bodies? I just think this business of government parenting over all of our lives is way out of control. We should make a law. Here's a law we should make. Let's make a law that says the government can't parent over all of our lives. I have an anecdotal report on the economy from Myrtle Beach. This was our seventh year in a row going to Myrtle Beach in the June timeframe. And every year we would go to a restaurant down there, the original Benjamin's all-you-can-eat Calabash-style seafood. And every year that we've ever gone to the original Benjamin's all-you-can-eat original Calabash-style seafood, we've had to wait in line, in a big line, out the front door, in this enormous buffet restaurant. I mean, they had five buffet lines of different foods, and then two dessert lines that you go through to get all kinds of ice creams and cakes and pies and everything. In this enormous restaurant, you have seats to the left, seats straight ahead, seats to the right, seats down below, seats up above. This year, I got out of the van and I said, I'll go put our name in. Well, I walked up. And immediately one of the waitresses right in the front door said, "Yes, sir. How many?" I said, "Well, there's, 10 of us." And she said, "Well, come this way." And there was no waiting for a table for 10 in this restaurant. And I can also tell you that every day at our hotel, we found a good parking spot, one under the tennis courts, the deck. So it's out of the sun, out of the rain or whatever. Every day we were able to get a good parking spot. Now, that's sort of anecdotal. Last year when we were there, we tried to stay an extra day at our hotel, and they said, "No, we're all filled up. This year, my wife asked the person behind the desk, what the occupancy rate was, and they said, "We are about half full." So there's a little anecdotal evidence for you on the state of the economy. As per Myrtle Beach. Are you liking the new iPhone 3.0 software improvements? Just talked to my neighbor and he said he loves the new, he loves the new iPhone 3GS. It fixed all the issues he had with the iPhone. But I like the new iPhone 3.0 software, even on my old 3G iPhone. One of the neatest things for me, if you're listening to podcasts, you've probably already noticed it, but there's now a 2x speed up built in to the iTunes player on your iPhone. And I use that on many podcasts that I listen to. I don't know if you're listening to it on this one or not, but if you are, good luck with that. I actually haven't used the copy and paste yet. It's built into the new iPhone 3 software. Sometimes it gets in my way when I'm trying to scroll and things. It tries to copy a section, but I did purchase a wireless headset for the iPhone now. Now that 3.0 is out, it allows stereo Bluetooth. At least I think it's stereo. I got on the web and did some research on people's reviews and things. I decided not to go with the Motorola headset. Instead, I went with the Plantronics Voyager. This headset is one of those that you see people wearing. And they look like a cyborg, right? It fits in one ear and it kind of extends in a bar, a little short bar extends down towards your mouth. But there's a cord that you can connect into that thing that loops behind your head then with an earpiece that goes in your other ear. That gives you the stereo sound. So it's sort of cordless, although there's a cord that goes around to the other ear, right? So that cord's not really in the way of your arms and things. And I can report to you that for $38 from Amazon, that Plantronics Voyager headset works pretty well. I know that some reviewers said when they're running with it, it doesn't work. It just cuts out. I've noticed some problems in when I would put the phone in, not sleep mode, but shut off the display by hitting the top button. Let's say I'm playing a podcast and I hit the top button to turn off the display. There have been occasions where the sound cuts out also. I was able to fix that by, at the bottom of the iTunes player, clicking on the button that says play through speakers. Then turning it off the display, and letting the sound continue through the speakers. Turning it back on, going back into the iTunes software, and changing it back to the headset, the Bluetooth headset. And then turning it back off, and it played properly in the Bluetooth headset. So a little bit of fiddling there to get it to work. But it's pretty cool, pretty cool. I've only tried it with a phone call once. I got a call, the little headset beeped. I tried to extend the boom microphone on it, and I tried to push the button to answer the call. It did not work, so I don't know. Don't know if this is going to be all right. But for $38, I like the fact that I'm cordless with my iPhone. Someone emailed me this interesting website called GulagWealthFund.com. You think the government's out of control? Well, invest in the out-of-control government. Hey, what? You know, if life gives you lemons, let's make lemonade. And if life gives you big government, let's invest in the Gulag Wealth Fund Index. Go to GulagWealthFund.com, like I'm going to try to do right now. Hold on. And so this is from Max Kaiser and Stacy Herbert. It's the Gulag Wealth Fund Index. And I think it'd be pretty cool if someone made this into an exchange-traded fund, don't you? It has several categories for out-of-control government, I guess. One category is the military. The other category is prisons. Then there's technology companies. I don't know why that's such a gulag thing. But logistics, gold, oil and resources. And I guess that's it. So in the military, for example, Lockheed Martin, MTC Technologies, Raytheon, and SAIC. Then under prisons, American Science and Engineering, Corrections Corp of America, GEO Group, KBR, Law Enforcement Associates, Taser International, and URS Corp. And then under logistics, Burlington Northern, Marsh & McLennan, News Corp, and Power Shares Water Resources. That's the ETF for that PHO. And under technology, Monsanto is one of the companies that's under there, as well as Kaki International, CACI. And Verichip is in the Gulag Wealth Index. So if you think there's too much government, invest accordingly. Saw an article reading through the blogosphere. Is Tiger Woods irrational? Loss aversion is a kind of irrationality where people care more about avoiding a loss rather than securing a gain of the same amount. For instance, if a person wins $50 while another identical person loses $50, the unlucky gambler will gain more unhappiness than the winner gains happiness. Because of this, people will expend more effort to avoid incurring a loss than they will in pursuit of an identical gain. Well, actually, if you look at this, it's not identical gain. We know that if you have $100 and you lose 50, that's a 100% loss. Whereas if you have $100 and you gain 50, that's not 100% gain. So it's not quite identical. But so they says in golf, for instance, in normal PGA tournament play, your score is just the number of strokes you took. And a stroke is a stroke, so it shouldn't matter much if it's a stroke to make a birdie or a stroke to make a par. If it's a stroke to make a birdie, it'll leave your score unchanged if it's missed. You know, you go on to make the par. But if you make a par, if you make a stroke for par, which if missed, will make your score one stroke worse. Yeah, well, both strokes are of equal importance. However, the stroke for par may count more in the golfer's mind. That's because if he doesn't make it, it looks like a loss. His score gets worse relative to par. But if he misses a birdie putt, it's just a foregone gain. His score stays the same in relation to par. If losses irrationally count for twice as much as gains in the golfer's mind, then he should try harder to make the par putt than the birdie putt. And as it turns out, it does. According to a recent golf study by Devin Pope and Maurice Schweitzer, PGA golfers are significantly more likely to make a par putt than the identical birdie putt. It's not even close. Overall, the difference is about 3 percentage points, and that's huge. The overall conversion rate for putts is 61%, and 3 points out of 61 is about 5%. In baseball terms, it's like a 96-66 team suddenly going 102-60 just by changing an irrational strategy. Well, Pope and Schweitzer did more than just count putt conversion rates, of course. After all, it's likely that a birdie putt are different from par putts in many ways. They might be farther from the hole. They might be in less advantageous places on the green. They're less likely to have followed other putts, which means the golfer doesn't have as good a read of the green. Birdie putts might be associated with different kinds of golfers. They might be associated with different difficulties of greens and so on and so forth. Well, the authors took all of these things into consideration, and their database is so extensive, over 1.6 million putts between 2004 and 2008, that the authors were even able to find thousands of matching pairs of putts where one was for birdie and one was for par, but where both were in almost exactly the same place on the green in the same round. The results held. Par putts were holed significantly more frequently than birdie putts. It turns out the difference is mostly length. When pros putted for birdie, they're more likely to leave the putt short than when they were putting for par. The idea is that the birdie golfers are playing conservatively. They want to make sure that if they don't sink the putt, they leave it close to the hole for an easy subsequent shot. On the other hand, the par golfers are scared to miss because that appears to cost them the loss of a stroke. So they make sure they give it enough weight. For putts of 22.5 feet or longer, birdie putters leave the ball about 2 inches shorter than par putters. All right. I'll have a link to the original study and to the blog post that talks about that study in the show notes for show 162 at madmanmachine.com. Some of the folks out at drop.io/madmanmachine are wondering some of the strange goings-ons with the Mad Money Machine. One person said, I'm wondering where he actually was and why he dropped his middle name. It's odd. Still a good show, though. Well, I just dropped my middle name just because I like to change things up. That's the only reason. And, you know, I don't use my middle name in everyday meetings with people. It sounds a little pretentious to me to go with three names. And I'm not a pretentious kind of guy, so it's Paul Boyer here. Although when I introduce myself in live person to other people, they invariably say, oh, Bob, is it? Or, oh, Bill? No, it's Paul. Paul. I guess I should. My name is Paul Boyer. Have to really enunciate. Another commenter, dropdio.io/madmanmachine, says, conspicuously missing show 161 without an IFA mention? Yes, folks. Didn't mention it on the previous show. But for the moment, I and my sponsors have gone separate ways. Not maliciously or off on, you know, in bad terms in any way whatsoever. But we've agreed to take a break from each other. And we don't know how long we'll take a break from each other. Maybe 6 months, maybe forever, maybe another week. I don't know. Probably 6 months or more, I would say, at least. And so, you know, that's good and bad. The good news is it frees me up to talk about all kinds of things that might not be becoming to a sponsor. The bad news, of course, is it doesn't force me to do a show every week. Aha! So that's why I didn't do a show in June. Well, that and truthfully, I was busy with a lot of other things too, like going to Myrtle Beach and packing up and doing all that kind of stuff. But yes, if I still had my sponsor in June, I might have found a way to pump out a couple of shows in June. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. So it's good and bad, and we'll just see how it goes. Someone said, I second that. I'm suffering from MMM withdrawal. Hope you get back to the mic soon. Take care. Well, thank you for the vote of support, folks, about listening to the Mad Money Machine. So one of the books that I read, most of it, was from Harry Brown. You know how I ordered those books from that discount site and got them in. Actually, I haven't read many of those, but there's an online book that's available from Harry Brown called How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. And this book is available at scribd.com. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. You can read it online for free in sort of a PDF format. I think you might actually even be able to download it in PDF format. I think it was written in the 70s, back when Harry Brown had a beard. You know, it's kind of funny looking through some of these old books. There are the author's photos back on that back flap. His more recent books have him with the tie and the silver hair and all that. But as you go back in time, these author's photos, his hair gets a little darker. And then as you go all the way back to the 70s, he doesn't have the tie on. He's got some sweater on. He's got a beard and dark hair. So it's really a different look for Harry Brown than what I'm used to. But in the first chapter of Freedom in an Unfree World, he says, freedom is the opportunity to live your life as you want to live it. The urge for freedom is so much a part of human nature that it can never be suppressed by laws, slogans, or commandments. There's a difference, however, between the urge and the reality. For most people, freedom remains a pleasant fantasy, something to dream of while carrying out daily obligations in the real world. They spend their lives talking vaguely of what they want in life, what they think they're missing, why they don't have it, and who it is that prevents them from being free. For most people, freedom is an if only it hadn't been for my wife, I would have been a success. Or, if only it hadn't been for Roosevelt or Nixon or whomever, the country would be free. The unfree person can never fully repress his urge for freedom, whether he considers his jailer to be his family, his job, society, or the government. And so, from time to time, half-hearted attempts are made to break free from the restrictions. But unfortunately, those attempts usually depend on the individual's ability to change the minds of other people, and so optimism eventually turns into frustration and despair. Hoping to be free, many people engage in continual social combat, joining movements, urging political action, writing letters to editors and congressmen, trying to educate people. They hope that someday it will all prove to have been worthwhile. But as the years go by, They see little overall change. Small victories are won, defeats set them back. The world seems to continue on its path to wherever it's going. Until they die, the hopeful remain just as enslaved as they've always been. The plans, the movements, the crusades, none of these things has worked. And so the unfree person continues to dream, to condemn, and to remain where he is. There must be a better way. There must be a way to be free without having to wish for a miracle. It must be a way by which the individual can change things without having to rely or to rally the rest of the world to his side. It has to be a way through which he can get rid of exorbitant taxes, have the time to do what he wants to do, enjoy love without tiresome complications, remove irritating social restrictions, and free himself from the 101 burdens that others daily hand him. And it must be a way that doesn't require that he re-educate all the other people involved. Fortunately, there is such a way. It isn't necessary to join a massive campaign to reconstruct the society in which you live, nor do you have to patiently re-educate everyone you deal with. There's a way that depends entirely upon what you choose to do. You can be free without changing the world. You can live your life as you want to live it, no matter what others decide to do with their lives. And I'll leave the rest of it for you to read. How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World by Harry Brown. Well, I think that about covers what I wanted to bring you this week. Thanks very much for listening. This is Paul Boyer. Saying it takes money to make money. And it takes finding freedom in an unfree world to make a mad money machine. I'll see you next time I do a show. Stay subscribed.